Mr. Coley, Rail 6. You sailed from Hong Kong to Busan. What were your first impressions of pulling into Busan?
American military band playing on the quayside, and all the band were black, and they were playing when the Saints couldn't march, I don't remember, in the jazz stadium, which was the American way, I think, and that was the welcome music. Straight off the ship onto a train, one of these no window trains, with a low class, with just wooden seats, and they were taken up to the country on a single track railway.
What are your memories of that journey?
The civilians come up trying to sell us different fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. They were turned in, they were told not to.
You'd been warned about that, had you?
Not to touch any. We ended up in a camp, a tented camp, big barking tents, probably told their force to, I can't remember, 20, 30, 40 to a tent. Just behind what's called Castle Hill, where the Gloucesters were invaded. That was our first introduction to desert lilies. I don't really know what desert lily is. But it's a shell case, dug into the ground at an angle, with the bottom taken off, and that's where you urinate. And it's called desert lilies. And that was my first introduction, and a lot of this, to these desert lilies. And they were up the sides of the roads all the way around the camp.
Do you remember the name of this camp?
No, not that camp.
I think it was Britannia that you went to.
Yes, you're right.
The Britannia camp. And this was a concentration area, presumably, where you got yourselves sorted out. Do you recall what you were doing there?
No, because we were only there about 3 weeks. And for the life of me, the only thing I remember is that there was a river running past it. And that was the only place for ablutions. And we had to get bathed in that river, we had to wash our clothes in that river and everything else. Otherwise, it was just a kicking out period. We had to get these long johns, then a pair of trousers, then a pair of cap-off trousers, then a pair of felt trousers, then a waterproof trouser. We had 5 pairs of trousers. And these were the first people to use tough boots with the big little soles on. And we'll give them the boot, no ball with them. That you do. And we'll give them the string vest and all this. We'll kit it out with winter clothing. The winter was coming on
to him. Did that include the heavy coats and
parkas? Yeah, safe skin parkas.
Were they good?
That is one thing I will say about the British contingent there. We were the best equipped troops in the career. The Americans would give us anything for the whole park if we could have seen them. They were very badly kitted out with the Americans for that sort of weather. But we have 3 pairs of gloves, each one with the two, you know, like mitts, but the trigger finger was always separate. A pair of sort of white ones that went underneath, and a woolly pair on the top, and another pair over the top of that, like a big coconut. And always the two you think it was loose. The park was perfect, big wire, just like Scott of the Antarctic sort of thing. And you could pull the wire down like that, so it only had a slit where your eyes were. And if you got it all in, you look like Michelin Man. Very effective, very effective. In these 5 pair of trousers with the waterproofs on the top, and the massive great big boots, you know, kind of things. You probably had a couple of pair of socks. You know, you had to get your boots 2 sizes too big.
Did you do any training at Britannia, you know, initial training?
Maybe? No, we were taken and familiarised with the terrain from Leninos, which was a bit bigger than the Lake District, so I think. We were shown positions similar to where we were going, but on a hill that had been occupied before, and showing what we were going to live in and things like that. And the first section went into, I think, called the first song.
Did they give you any talks about Koreans and Korean, the war itself, the Chinese and North Koreans. You didn't get any lectures on them prior to going in. And you're there about 3 weeks. So this would be what, October-ish, that kind of time? And the first hill that you moved on to, do you recall it?
Yes, I was wounded there within a week.
What do you recall of the journey up to it?
It was at night. As we were going in, the battalion officers, the battalion officers coming off, they were moving out as we moved in, so we were told, that's your chief.
But they were already prepared, or they were already there. And you have taken over their positions and their hutches. What is a hutche? Can you describe it?
Oh, on the side of a hill, with the local trees that we could find cut down and put across as rafters, across the top, sandbags on the top of that, there'll be 2 to 3 layers of sandbags, tarpaulin if you're looking over the top of that. Inside you had just a cabin, and you had to get all the pickets, you know, the barbed wire pickets, drive them into the walls, straight into the walls, probably 6 foot apart, and then one picket across at the edge. And we were to try and get these belts for the machine guns, the empty belts, and we strapped those around the arm and the bed. A sling bed, you saw the hammock, so that was your bed. Heating was an adaption of a shell case and a canadaser and a rubber tube. And the canadaser stayed on top of the witchy with a rubber tube coming through the doorway and dripping into the shell case. Light it, and it used to glow, get red hot. Then the other shell case, you would like cut the bottom off, and you had a chimney going through, out through the side. And it's very dangerous. But it kept you warm, and it was just a drip of diesel. A drip every 2 seconds out of this red hot base. And it used to just heat the shell case up till it got red hot. And that was your heating system. That was in the winter. You didn't need it in the summer.
Feeding again.
That was done by colour sergeants with wagons. Colour sergeant Camby. Who was later killed. He burned to death in his tent. He used to come up and it was made his shoes. Things like that. Was that funny enough?
You'd get one hot meal a day?
Yes, that? Usually 4 or 5 or something after me. Yes, that K rations.
And what were K rations?
It was a cardboard box full of tins of corned beef hash, tins of custard, some cigarettes, some chocolate, and stuff like that. Chewing gum, toilet paper.
Was this an American pack?
American pack. You've got one of all the deal. And I think Korea was littered with corn beef hash. That was the first one that I know for sure that it was possible. Any other stuff in the steel? We've got malted milk. The burning candle in the middle of the table, you used to pull it. The candle used to freeze and heat the malted milk up and then used to drink it.
So it was pretty good, was it, all in all?
Yeah, and then they used to scramble eggs and things like that. Then one day there, it was usually steel and rice pudding or something like that. But Prince Adam Camby was very famous for his what they call Camby's dumplings. I think we'd only Prince Adam ever used to do dumplings in the steel. And they were called Camby dumplings. They were big, thick, solid flour dumplings.
So had your own cooks with you then?
Yes, the Eskimo had their own cooks, but they were way back. Then you used to have the 1500 weight in the back, and then you used to have the, when we were in the line, we used to have to go down with the thing with your mess tins, your pot, and your tea, and you just fill your mess tin with the dumplings and the steel. Little mess tin, small mess tin with your rice pudding or whatever you have, and your cup of tea, and then you have to get back to your hutch and eat it. I always remember one lad who was running down. The Chinese got wise to this freezing times, if they did a bearing, and they used to start and send the mortars over somewhere, and there was a bad one to me, and and run back up this hill, about 100 yards up the hill, to get back to the hutches. Because he couldn't make the cross with the 1500 there. And he fell, and his shoulder Duncan's went on the grass here, and his wife's put him next to it, and he looked at it, and he looked down the hill again, and he had to go back down the hill. And he scared no back, and he said, I looked at it. And he scared no back, and one missed his wife, but he scared Duncan a lot, and carried on up. He wasn't got a chance to go back down again. Yeah. But those are just little things you remember.
Where were the toilets in relation to your hutches?
Halfway down the hill, and it was usually a hole dug in the ground, a deep hole, with a tin chest with a hole cut through the top, nothing around it. We used to sat on there, in the open. There were no civilians, none of them.
And had they to be moved as they filled, as it was?
We just put, we used to get bags of lime. We used to throw the lime in and fill them up and dig them over. But there was never any finesse about the whole thing. It was just probably 50 yards away from the other two, and all dug in the ground. The teacher, that's what we used to do, get a teacher, put a hole in the door. Just like the old dry mountains we used to do.
And were you paraded on the morning, or?
Once you've got into those positions, you're section, you're the only person that's been paraded for is your corporal, always has in charge, this section sergeant, section corporal, whatever it is. The officer used to come around once a day and see you're all right, say the coaches were not dirty, you know, I mean, just fine, they could walk in. And then they realised you were left here, and then apart from carrying out the duties of the second of the month's cleaning.
What time would your day start?
Well, it never finished, never started, because the machine guns fired at night. And it was in the night fire, it was the set the other day. It was night fire started, you had to set up the guns in the afternoon, set up the targets in the daylight. In the afternoon, and then have a rest, and then after dark, after the turn of day, we would check the dial sites and everything at a certain time of fire, and it's 5,000 euros at that time, it's 12 targets, finally, 5,000 euros, change models, go back to the other time.
We'll come to that in more detail later. Can we have a look at the composition of the battalion, not so much from companies and S companies which we've dealt with. Who was commanding?
Colonel Jeffries.
And what was he like as a commanding officer?
Great. I can't say anything else, he could work with me. But he was, he was a good officer. I liked him.
Did you see a lot of him? Was he present?
Every day. If he didn't come and visit you personally, he would pass away. He knew every man was. He knew every man by name. And I can ever remember him. He knew everybody. He knew where everybody was. He knew your exact positions. He knew your targets. He knew everything. He was absolutely normal.
And presumably much like throughout the whole battalion?
Oh, yes, yes. Very well, very well. I think he was the best man for that job.
I think you said the 2IC was Major Norman. And
he was the one who was doing all the administration.
Do you remember any of the officers at battalion headquarters? Adjutant, for example?
No. I remember Doreen, he was UD, as I said before. Atkinson. Most of the NCOs had quite a few good officers. He arrived and maybe got wounded. I don't know if you heard of a stick grenades the Chinese did.
We'll come to the, actually we'll talk about the weaponry that the Chinese had. I just want to get to, you know, again, obviously there had been some changes in the battalion since you'd moved back from Berlin. It's to get a picture of who they were and what they were. You still had your same officer commanding your...
We were nearly all the time, apart from one section in the middle where we had, I don't know where Captain Greenwood went. But we got Captain Montbauer, for a short time.
Did the day start with Stand 2?
No, we never knew Stand 2.
Actually, that's right, you'd been operating during the night.
We sort of the night off, and then the infantry took over the daylight. We would probably be asleep by 8 o'clock. We cleaned every realise, I mean, there's 30,000, probably 40,000 empty cases between us. And according to Tim's, you saw that photograph where all the tubes were, we still full of empty casings.
So it had to be pretty tidy, hadn't you? Had to pick stuff up. I was going to ask you about rats and other creatures. They were pretty prevalent, you say, the rats.
We are taking over some emergency positions there later on, and the emergency were just particular as us, and they were the rats. But we didn't get quite as many, but we still got rats. I mean, whatever there's food and men, then you get rats.
Lice, were they? Did you get lice?
And it was cold. We had a hot night principle for all the creatures.
You still looked at out for them. You looked out for lice.
You had to look for them. Things like that. We didn't have
Where was the machine guns in relation to the rest of the battalion on the positions?
We were given a position probably with each company, and each company had their own idea. We were given a machine gun position probably in the centre of the company had probably 100 yards front to look after facing the enemy. We were probably given a position in the centre, so we had a range, you know, a big phase of the fire from.
Were these trench positions?
Trench positions, yeah.
First World War style trenches.
Yes, the hutches were at the back of the trench. You had to come out of the trench and round and into the hutches. And there was never any entrance into the hutches from the trench itself. You had to go out of the trench, into the little trench, and then round the back. As you saw that photograph, the trench was the other side.
And there were traverses too.
The traverses to the
in the trenches. Yeah. For protection as well.
Yes, there was holes, bore holes, down the pits. There were bore holes in the pits.
The machine gun position, a section of you would be with the company, as you said. How were they built into the infantry positions?
We had a hutch with a hole at the other side. We had a fairly fire out of a hole. And you went into the hutch through the side of the trench. And then it was a platform that was being left on the gear. You go with on the platform so you could store sound and fire instead of sitting down. And you had a big flame of fire, probably 180 degrees. Each gun, and each gun's covered a different 180. And then you throw the lap in the middle. So that you had a 360 degrees.
And was this fixed lines firing? Or
well, you could do fixed lines, you could do die side firing at night, you could do anything, you could do close end corners, you wanted to steal the Chinese, run up the hill back in, you could depress the road and just hit them.
And you said at night time you had the task of firing on.
Yeah, firing on. They used to pick these targets out like loads with the Chinese, or they knew that they were used the trucks, or they knew that they were. Certain things, ammunition or whatever, and we just keep quiet.
Did they retaliate to that fire?
No. Apart from mortars. Even with the mortars, at least 3 or 4 times a day, we were.
They're pretty good up with the mortars, I understand.
Oh, yes.
Now, we can actually talk a little bit about the Chinese weapons now. We've mentioned the mortars. You mentioned the stick grenades.
Yeah, the foot grenades. Just a piece of wood with an explosive in it at the end, like a dumper. And it was more, you couldn't kill it, just used to, you know, spin the stick in and the man, it was there, the man. And this officer said, Grout, the colour. He had arrived on the morning, was sent up to all positions on that night. We'd go out and have a look to see what it was, and somebody threw a stick in and he came out and we'd take him out of his backside. He didn't have to go to the hospital very much, did he? We just had to take his trousers down and pull these splinters out of his backside. He was very embarrassed.
And there are other weapons, which are?
These mortars, they have heavy artillery. You can hear that whining. I think they were naval guns, actually. They were, you know, 60 naval guns, something like that. when you saw them, they had sort of a way of their tubes not armed very well. But I think what their idea was that they exploded the mines, but they were able to come off them. Then after that, they, what did they call it? A goop gun?
Burp gun, was
burp
it?
Burp gun. That was something like the same one. But it was very deceiving. Otherwise, the rifles, I didn't even look about the rifles. The burp gun and these, and they had swords.
Were these officers or NCOs or what
they had? Mainly the officers used to chase the others in front of them with these swords.
We'll come to their tactics probably later. You mentioned the minefields and mines.
Yes, they were strung out. There was sort of 10 yards in front of all the guns in the position. But they done it with the fire with the minefields, but the guns we had done with lanes through it, all the guns through our people. The patrol used to go out through those lanes at night.
Which you wouldn't be on, but you would know they were going out. Well, the minefields, as you say, clearly marked. I think there's quite a number of accidents with mines early on.
Early on, but there's no way with that. The only thing that you have to watch out for was we'd gone forward a little bit and there was a lot of mines behind us, and you have to be careful wherever you went at the back, because they were being totally forgotten. The wires were still there with the marks on, but you could easily wander. The only city we ever tried any gap with the Americans. We had one of, you know, the flares, we used to send flares just around the end, have a look at no man's land. And one of these flares had blown on the wind and come into the minefield that was just to the left of us. And these Americans were there. And it was a lovely big silk parachute, of course, about 6 foot across, pure silk. And he went out, and I said, you can't get that. I said, in the middle of the minefield. Oh, I'll get it. He got his leg blown off. Trying to get it. We never ventured into the silk parachute. We stopped the hour of time for us, and we didn't go. One of the things I remember, we captured we brought a body in. We had a Chinese paper or whatever it was that we did. We got one of the Koreans to interpret this or translate it. And it had, put it really crudely, advice to the Chinese soldier, the North Korean soldier. If the hero is well lit and noisy, attack it, it's American. If it is quiet and dark, leave it alone, it's British.
So they got to know their opponents pretty well.
You could see them on the line. I mean, looking at night, you could see where the Americans were. They used to drive the jeeps with full headlights blazing. They were absolutely crackers. But our heroes were always, you could never, even when you lit a cigarette, you went under something. This was instilled in us. Did not show a light, did not make a noise. And that was the advice given them, was perfect for these troops. If it's noisy a little, attack it.
Where was the Italian, the Chinese positions in relation to your own?
It all depends where you were.
Well, I'm thinking of this very first hill.
Probably a mile away.
And it was across a valley, was it, or something?
Yeah, across a valley. We were there twice on that position. Towards the first position, then later on, we were there. It was across a wide valley, very wide. Mm-hmm.
There were two raids carried out in those very early days. There were two, I think, Bladen and, you don't recall Bladen and Willington raids.
I was never on board.
So you'd moved on to this position on arriving in Korea, or arriving at your first battle position there. And you said you were wounded very shortly after that.
Yeah, probably a week after.
How did that come about?
Well, after the night's fighting, thing was that we always had to strip the guns and clean them. And being green, We brought the gun out, stretched a poncho out on the ground behind the woodchain, stripped the gun out the poncho, and we cleaned it, and the water bomb ran smack in the middle. And I had me back to it, I had cleaners and been talking to somebody. There's a lad called Bates to the other side, and a lad called Lops, and he had his back to it, talking to somebody else, and we all cleaning all the little bits and parts. And I was hit in the back of the neck, and this arm, Bates was hit right in the neck. And Robson's both shoulders were shattered. So we ended up in three of us, or the one section.
The initial impact, did you feel it?
No, I didn't feel it. Those two felt. They were breathing badly. And I never felt a thing. And this lad that's on the photograph, Ian's, he was the other member of the section, and he came up and said, come on, I was a bit dazed with the explosion. And he says, come on, we'll take him to the machine. I went in, I took my tin hat off, and it was full of blood. And I never felt a thing, and when he looked, I was hitting him, and all this was gashed. So they sent for the medic, the young lad that was using, Red Cross. And he came, and maybe he took a big pack out of his, pad, with the tails on his thing, and he stuck it on the back of my neck, pulled it down there, put two of his back again, and then fainted, and he had all of the smith. Things and I was choking me. I always remember that. And then this same mash, this helicopter arrived, and they stuck it on the side of this helicopter way back into this American mash.
Were you attended to? Was there a doctor with you? A battalion doctor with you?
No, you were wish straight away on the back of a jeep that used to come up with the racks on. And I managed to get there, and I managed to get that taken off in that. You're on the outside, you're looking at this. But it was only half a mile. Looked down, stayed with the American map, tipped off this stretch under a nice cold rubber sheet, belly flapped down. American man's doctor's there. He said, well, I'm going to put you out, bang, and that's the last thing I remember.
And what did they do to you?
They took shrapnel out of here, shrapnel out of the back.
That's out the back of your shoulder?
Yeah, back of the arm there. Back of the neck, and I woke up in a large. Well, I woke up and it was all I could see was these white awnings hanging down. The one we put inside of my case. But I didn't know what it was. It was just a white awning. And this nurse, all in white, and she was blonde, standing beside this trumpet. And I thought I was in it. I thought it was an angel, but just didn't know where I was. And what they'd done, I was sort of. Hurt here and hurt here, so they put me like that. And Bates, your lad that was hurt, he was hurt on this side, so they made him.
On his neck, yeah.
And he was facing that when I was facing him there. And I said to him, I said, why can you not just have the carry on that side of him, or him around here, so we can look at each other and talk? So he did. And I was in there probably a week. And then they said, right, we'll send you off to Incheon, the rest of the relaxation time at Incheon.
So you healed pretty quickly, had you?
Oh, yes. Well, the stitches were there, but they transferred, they couldn't keep it in the mash, you see.
And the treatment actually within the mash itself, I'm not talking about so much the medical treatment, but the people, and how did they handle you? Were they sympathetic or what?
Great, but they were so pushed that they didn't have much time for you that way. I forgot, they did transfer me to Seoul, into what the university did at the time, or tell about the chap. People I met there, the doctor was shattered. He was at the next bed to me, and of course, with his shoulder shattered, he was strapped up and he couldn't shave, so I had to shave him. And if he wanted to go to the toilet, I had to take him and the baggage behind for him and things like that. And I had to lower him onto the pot, the busty bits had disappeared, I don't know where they'd take him. But this rock's I was never shaving him and baggage behind for him.